Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Jeremiah Roberts, one of the co-hosts here at Cultish. Believe it or not, we are at the end of the year again. It's the end of 2022. We're so thankful for all of you who have supported us this past year. We are a completely crowdfunded, listener-supported ministry, but as of right now, of everyone who listens in to our content, both on our podcast and our YouTube, we only have roughly less than 1% of those who give, those who donate. So it goes to say that the only way the Cultish can continue to next year is that we do need to get support by the end of the year. We're trusting God with that. So please, prayerfully consider going to the Cultish Show. .com. There is a donate tab. You can donate one time or become a monthly partner with us. Help us to continue to be salt and light. We are headed into our fifth year of broadcasting and also headed into 2023, a brand new year, brand new topics, brand new challenges. TheCultishShow.com. You can go to the donate tab. There is a one-time or monthly donation you can commit yourself to. Help us go into 2023 to allow weekly content like this to continue. And thank you so much for supporting this past year. Now, enjoy this podcast.
My name is Eddie, and I was in a call.
Planet Earth about to be recycled. Your only chance to survive or evacuate is to leave with us.
Started as an effort by a charismatic preacher to build a new society, but it ended, of course, with the tragic deaths of more than 900 people.
Please, for God's sakes, let's get on with it. We've lived as no other people have lived and loved. We've had as much of this world as you're going to get. Let's just be done with it. Let's be done with the agony of it. It's the revolutionary suicide. This is not a self-destructive suicide. So they'll pay for this. They brought this upon us.
You're in a cult. I love you, and I want you out of it and with Christ.
But you're...
All right, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Cultish, entering the kingdom of the cults. My name's Jeremiah Roberts, one of the co-hosts here. Appreciate you all waiting patiently for chapter two of our discussion on Seventh-day Adventism. Very, very excited, super excited, of course, for this episode. As always, I'm joined with Andrew, the super sleuth of the show from a super secret headquarters up in Utah. It's good to have you in for chapter two on Seventh-day Adventism.
Oh, yeah, I'm excited, man. I'm just chilling here somewhere deep, dark past the Orion's Belt, waiting to dive more waiting to dive more into the Seventh-day Adventist great controversy, I guess.
Excellent, excellent. Well, very, very happy to have both of you on. Thank you so much for coming on. Colleen and Nikki, it's good to have you back. Just very quickly before you jump in, just tell everyone just a little bit about yourself, your ministry, and what makes you somewhat to be knowledgeable on the subject we're going to talk about today.
Well, I'm Colleen Tinker, and I am the editor of Proclamation Magazine, which is produced by Life Assurance Ministries. My husband, Richard, and I are founding board members of Life Assurance Ministries, which started in the year 2000. It was founded by former Adventist pastor Dale Ratzlaff. Richard is now the president of the ministry. And Nikki and I also are co-hosts of the Former Adventist podcast, which has been in operation for about 2 years and has developed a whole new audience. But we exist to expose the truth of Adventism and to show Adventists the true gospel. And it's for people who are questioning and leaving Adventism, and it's also for concerned Christians who really want to understand what this religion is about.
Okay. Go ahead.
And I'm Nikki. I was in Adventism for 30 years. I got saved in 2010 through the work of this ministry. They acted as an interpreter, in a sense, helping me understand the language differences between Christianity and Adventism. And in doing that, I was able to understand the gospel for the first time. So I came to faith at 30, and I have been working with Life Assurance Ministries since then, writing for them and co-hosting with Colleen. Came out with my husband, by the way, and our two children have never been Adventist.
That's a wonderful thing.
And real quickly,
they grew up eating meat.
Yeah. Yes. And real quick before we jump in, where's the website where people can find out more about you? They want to find out more about your ministry, resources, so forth and so on.
ProclamationMagazine.com. is our major website, and you have links from there to our other places, including our YouTube channel, the podcast, and so forth.
What's up, everybody? It's the Super Sleuth here, here to ask you a really personal question. Are you single? If you are, I bet you are tired of those Christian dating websites that treat people like a commodity rather than being made in the image of God that they are, meaning that you're endlessly scrolling through results and sending messages to many people that have no substance. If that's you, here's the best solution. It's called higherbond.com. They are built for Christian people who value their faith, right, as the guiding force behind every decision in life. This is real Christian dating, guys. They send you batch matchmaking results, 3 to 5 people per day, but you can only choose one person to send a message to, meaning that you're actually taking your time to get that message sent. And if you're struggling with sending that message, they actually give you guided first message questions that you can actually ask through them in order to give you a conversation with substance. Higherbond.com is also offering 3 months free right now. No obligation, no credit card information. Go to higherbond.com/cultish and sign up today and become a member.
Excellent. And as always, just before we jump in, we also want to let you know that a program like Cultish would not be possible without your support. We are coming towards the end of the year. So if you want to support Cultish and allow programs like this to continue to have content like this, which has been long awaited, please go to thecultishshow.com. There is a donate tab. You can donate one time or become a monthly partner with us. So definitely, please, I would ask you prayerfully consider donating so we can keep this program here on the air. All right. So we are going to be talking our podcast today. The second chapter's title is very controversial. It's called Is Seventh-day Adventism a Cult? So we spent chapter one really talking about Ellen G. White, the Millerites, what was going on at that time historically, just the everything entailed. Definitely check out chapter one if you haven't listened to that yet. But we're going to be talking about really contextually, after Ellen G. White passed away, it was not considered a Christian organization from your perspective. And it wasn't until actually Walter Martin wrote the appendix to Kingdom of the Cults. Well, he wrote Kingdom of the Cults, but Seventh-day Adventism showed up in an appendix. Tell us about that and explain the controversy behind that.
Well, the interesting thing was Walter Martin, who was a close friend and colleague of a man actually older than he, but it was Donald Gray Barnhouse. They were colleagues. And Walter Martin had already written and done research on Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses and had labeled them in print as cults. And so the Adventists knew that Walter Martin was investigating the so-called Christian cults. And one of the leaders of Adventism, whose name was Leroy Froom, he was from the General Conference. He had a specific capacity, and he contacted Walter Martin and asked if he could have an interview with him because Froom did not want him to investigate Adventism and label it a cult, even though it primarily was considered a cult up until that time. So Walter Martin made arrangements to meet with Froom, but behind the scenes, and I think that this is where many things went off the rails that were not known at first. The Adventist organization carefully handpicked the people who would meet with Walter Martin, prepped them, chose people who understood how to talk to non-Adventists, and set up a series of meetings. And Walter Martin, who was only 26 years old at the time, met with these older men who were rather experienced in dealing with the evangelicals, and the rest is history. That was the beginning.
What about you, Nikki? Do you have any commentary or thoughts on that you're aware of?
No, that she said it well.
Okay, excellent. And so what's interesting is that every single edition of Kingdom of the Cults has Seventh-day Adventism listed in an appendix. And for my understanding, and this has just always been the case, which goes to show that as much as we love Dr. Walter Martin, he's been he had such an amazing impact in this area of Christian apologetics. But you also have to understand, too, that no one is perfect. We deal the best given the information that we're dealing with. But it did create a lot of controversy, particularly.
Oh, yes.
Tell everyone just what was some of the fallout when it showed up in the appendix versus a definitive cult? Because you have Mormonism, the section on Jehovah's Witnesses, by the way, is excellent. It's so thorough, both historically, theologically, and you have Scientology, Mormonism, all these categories. But there's Seventh-day Adventism in the appendix. What sort of controversy did that create?
Well, it was huge. It was a huge controversy both in Christianity and within Adventism by the time this was all done. Because the fact is, Adventism from the beginning and has never actually changed except for in the way it's worded at the, you know, on the outside for the public to read. Adventism has always had a different worldview than Christianity, but it has a vocabulary difference. So while the words sound the same, the vocabulary changes. And over time, Adventism had cleaned up a lot of its definitions. It began overtly as an anti-Trinitarian, Arian to semi-Arian religion that grew out of the Millerite movement. It wasn't the Millerite movement that determined its doctrines. The Millerite movement only brought together the people who coalesced into what became Seventh-day Adventism, along with many other groups that we're not dealing with today. But the Millerite movement was only like the solution in which the coalescence happened. Mm-hmm. So these people came together, and the primary leaders were James White, Joseph Bates, both of whom were from the Christian Connection, staunchly and verbally anti-Trinitarian. Ellen White, who was a visionary, and James White married her mostly because her visions promoted, he gave him something to sell, something to attract the people. Her visions became a means of actually money-making because he could sell them and attract a following. Mm-hmm. So as they did this, their doctrines were all formed around this anti-Trinitarian stance, this belief that God, including the Father, had a body, that man does not have a spiritual nature, is only a body that breathes. And these fundamental differences in the natures of reality have always shaped Adventism. So this was the thing that I know Walter Martin didn't fully understand, or any of the Christians at the time, but it's what really set Adventism apart. It learned to use normal Christian words about atonement, sacrifice, Jesus, Trinity. It used normal Christian words, unlike the Mormons, who actually admitted they had God the Father and Jesus, you know. Mm-hmm. So they were a little more open about their beliefs. So were the Jehovah's Witnesses. But Adventism was truly deceptive, and the longer they existed, the more deceptive they became. Mm-hmm. So that was what really underlay what happened in the 1950s with Walter Martin. He believed their words. These people got together and decided they would use vocabulary that would convince Walter Martin that they were truly Christian. But he didn't look under the surface at the roots. And I just want to say, any organization that is founded out of a traditional heresy, such as Arianism or anti-Trinitarianism, and never renounces it, never goes back on it, but just alters the way it talks, it's the root that determines the nature of that organization. Mm. It's not what they say 20 years, 30 years, 100 years later.
Okay. And Nikki, do you have any commentary or thoughts?
Well, as far as the controversy around the Kingdom of the Cults book, I can't speak a lot to the history there, but I can tell you, as an Adventist growing up in an Adventist home, I saw that book in our home, out on the counter. And it's a strange way to process it. But I thought, oh, yeah, see, we're not a cult because we have a book about the cults. So we're not a part of the cults. And I remember it wasn't until I was an adult that I knew that the Adventists were in the appendix of that. And I thought, ooh, we came really close, didn't we?
Yeah.
And I kind of like, felt like we dodged a bullet a little, but yeah. We believed we were the remnant. And so, of course, we'd be a little peculiar and people wouldn't quite get us. But it's kind of like just being misunderstood. You know, it wasn't a problem. So somehow I felt vindicated
and special
by having it around.
Well, just interesting because just at least for me, almost like an unconscious level, I remember the first I went to a high school that was 98% Mormon. I think I mentioned that. And I had like two or three classmates that were Seventh-day Adventist. And for them,
interesting.
Yeah, I just always, anytime I've heard about people who are SDA, and even I've had coworkers, I think I went to a baby shower one time at a Seventh-day Adventist congregation because my coworker was there and his wife, they were expecting. And it seems like they were people who were Christians who were just maybe misunderstood a little bit. Like, I just, then when you mention that, it just comes to mind. That was sort of my mindset that I've had continually. And that I feel like even now, sort of looking at this material and even talking to you, I feel still like that's my mindset. Maybe that's indicative of a lot of our audience. Real quickly, we are going to play a clip in just a moment. That's going to be a catalyst for our conversation. But Andrew, I heard you jumping in here. What questions did you have real quickly about this?
Yeah. So just to give like a little bit of a timeline, Walter Martin and Barnhouse and a few other people, they met with the Seventh-day Adventists, specific people like Colleen mentioned, which I think would be great if she talked about that and the importance of that later. But this was between 1955 and 1956, and there was a series of 18 different meetings. But could you paint for a picture for us real quick, guys? Like, what was the growth of the Seventh-day Adventists like? Let's say, I'm going to use 1863, for example, just because that's the date when they, you know, become an organization, although they existed prior before then. But from 1863 to 1955, like, what was the growth of the SDA organization like? Oh, were there colleges now? Was there exponential growth?
Because, good question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there definitely were. They definitely had a whole system of colleges. Loma Linda University was in existence. It is their flagship medical school.
Andrews University?
But I say Andrews University did exist. Right? Their seminary existed. They have, I know I can't name them all, but I know there's Walla Walla College in the Pacific Northwest. There's Pacific Union College in Northern California, La Sierra University in Southern California. There's
Atlantican University.
Atlantic in Massachusetts.
It's in South Lancaster, Massachusetts. I think it might be closed now.
But it existed
very recently.
Yeah, very recently. There's Southern Adventist University in Tennessee. There's Southwestern in Keene, Texas. And then there were a host of boarding academies and day academies that existed by then. And very importantly, a whole chain of hospitals. And that was worldwide. There were Adventist hospitals everywhere, especially in North America. But it was their primary and still is probably their primary evangelistic tool, the health message.
Yeah. Like,
so organizationally, it had expanded.
Yeah, so it seems to me like during this time around 1955, 1956, and then they released the Questions on Doctrine in 1957 in direct result of the conversations that they had with Walter Martin and Barnhouse. But it seems like they're trying to save face, right? Because they have so much on the line. Because back then, information didn't travel the same way it does now, where we can just go on the internet and look things up. When if Walter Martin is working on a book that will definitely call something a cult, anyone who is reading these types of material are going to be very well educated now on how to handle the situations. And that's really bad publicity back then. So I find that to be really interesting. And just to note too, I think Walter Martin, which maybe you guys can talk about, but he was concerned about the following things. He was concerned that the Seventh-day Adventists taught that the atonement of Christ was not completed on the cross, right? That salvation is a result of grace plus works of the law. We kind of went into that in chapter one, but that also Jesus was a created being, and that he partook of man's sinful fallen nature in his incarnation. And all of these things were supposedly handled in the response on the Questions and Doctrine, correct?
Correct. Supposedly. Did you want me to comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, please.
Okay. As far as the atonement and the nature of Christ were the two primary things that were of the greatest concern, perhaps from the Adventist side, because they were the two things that were the hardest to explain in Christian terms. Because Adventism, because of Ellen White's teaching on the investigative judgment, Adventism had always believed, and I have to say, still does officially teach, that Christ's atonement was not completed on the cross. So how were they going to convince Walter Martin that they were Orthodox? Well, they used a clever way of defining it. They said that Jesus's death was the sacrificial provision provided, but that he applies it in heaven. And they worded it in a way so that Christians would think, well, sure, Jesus is our high priest in heaven. So everything he accomplished is being mediated for us as believers. That's how they understood. They worded it so that Walter Martin would see it that way. In reality, they were hiding the fact that that they didn't believe that the entire atonement was completed at the cross, because Adventists do not believe that when you, quotes, accept Jesus, and I say that in quotes because for them, it's a different thing from trusting and being born again. But they taught that when you accepted Jesus, then all your past sins were forgiven, but all your future sins had to be individually confessed and forgiven because of Jesus applying his blood in heaven. But they couldn't say that to Walter Martin because that's clearly heretical. So they morphed the words. So they had these two things. The sacrificial atonement provided, and then the sacrificial atonement applied. So that was the least of their problems. Interestingly, the Adventist historian George Knight, who wrote an introductory set of annotations to a republished edition of Questions on Doctrine in 2003, he actually states that they didn't exactly tell the truth when they talked about the nature of Christ. They reasoned and rationalized that they were dealing with very rigid and stubborn dispensational Calvinists in the persons of Walter Martin and Barnhouse, who definitely wouldn't understand what they were trying to say. So they tried to make him understand. And they actually said in the book, Questions on Doctrine, they stuck in an extra heading in the chapter on the nature of Christ where they said he took on sinless humanity. But that had never been the traditional teaching of Adventism.
Yeah.
And so it went from there. It was a deception, and it threw everybody into confusion.
And just for anyone kind of jumping in, because we are really, this is a fire hose of information, and we're so appreciative for both of you coming on. No, it's no problem at all. Nothing to apologize for. For anyone, just we want to make sure we define terms. Questions on Doctrine, just very quickly explain what that book was. In fact, that's actually one of the pictures that we have on the graphics for this episode. Tell everyone what that book was, who wrote it, and what is the nature of the book in relation to the appendix that was written by Dr. Walter Martin in Kingdom of the Cults and this whole conversation?
Sure. Questions on Doctrine was the fruit of these meetings that the Adventists had with Walter Martin. He presented his concerns, and they crafted a book that would answer his concerns in a way that satisfied him and satisfied the evangelicals and allowed for evangelicals to extend the right hand of fellowship to them and prevent them from being categorized with the cults. So you look at the chapters as an evangelical, and I'm assuming that it sounds okay, maybe a little bit off here and there, but it was accepted. And it was accepted at the advisement of Eternity Magazine and Walter Martin and Barnhouse. But the Adventists, when they saw this book, the majority of them felt betrayed because it was using language they didn't understand. It was, and you have to understand that the doctrines that came out of Seventh-day Adventism and Ellen White, they were remnant last-day doctrines that if you failed to hold on to, you would receive the mark of the beast and die. So it felt like apostasy to traditional Adventists to see a book like this come out and start altering lessons that came from the throne room of God, according to their convictions. So it just sent cracks all through Adventism. Yeah. And you had people who were embarrassed and ashamed of Adventism embracing it. But I would argue that even in their embracing of Questions on Doctrine, they didn't know the gospel. Even if the words sounded closer, they didn't know how to redefine it and understand it.
Okay.
In fact, the very conservative Adventists who were not included in the writing of Questions on Doctrine, including Adventism's greatest theologian, whose last name was Andreasen, he was deliberately excluded, not just not invited. He was told not to help, not to attend the meetings, not to help with the writing. And even he, at the very end of it all, after the book was published, admitted in his way, he said, "This book has not repudiated any of our traditional doctrines, except," he would argue, "it repudiated the Adventist view of atonement, because it really morphed the way they understood the three-part or two-part atonement." Some people said three, some people said two. So, but it did not repudiate, but yet people thought it repudiated it, which I think illustrates the problem within Adventism. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Apologia Studios. Cultish would not be possible if it wasn't for Apologia Studios, where we film our show and record our show out of. So if you want to support the studio, which will allow Cultish to remain weekly content for you to enjoy, please go to apologiastudios.com. You can become an all-access member And that will, again, will support the studio, which will allow Cultist to be a possibility for you to enjoy on a weekly basis. Now, back to the episode. Very interesting. In fact, I just want to state something real quickly, and then Andrew or you both can give me some commentary and give me your thoughts, is that when it comes to communication in the area of the Kingdom of the Cult, is that there's a distinction between material and content that's written by the organization for members of the organization versus content that's specifically made by the organization and how they communicate to non-members. So like one example of fragmentation that happened in the Mormon church, and this would have been, I believe in the 90s when Gordon B. Hinckley was the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I believe he was on an interview with 60 Minutes, and he was asked by the host whether or not they believe that they can become a god. Now this is central Mormon doctrine, like this is Mormon Orthodoxy 101, and Gordon B. Hinckley, given the publicist that he was, you know, he tried to explain it away as like, yeah, that's just some sort of very like deep doctrine we don't know much about. And so he was trying to save face for the outside. But then people on the inside of Mormonism, there became this real big fragmentation. So all of a sudden, something that was so sacred and precious to them, and the reason why they're going through to go to the temple day after day to do all these things, to complete all these works, this is now some sort of vague, deep doctrine. And from then, like, yeah. Mormonism started to fragment in this post into something that's postmodern. But I think there's a huge distinction between those two. But a lot of times, even the members internally, they even though the organization up front is trying to save face, when a member reads that, there's almost a language barrier that begins to start to create fragmentation. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely true. That's what happened with questions on doctrine.
Yeah, and it's also produced generations of Adventists now who maybe they have more evangelical language, but the definitions are still Adventist. So now you go, like I shared with you guys last time, I would go to Christian concerts and I would go to conferences and I'd hear them talk. And I would sit there probably about as confused as Christians feel when they listen to an Adventist talk. Yeah. It almost sounded right. I wasn't sure what they knew that I didn't, because they were so much happier than I was. But I thought we believed the same thing. But so it became for the younger generations coming out of that, it became not so much a reform for us. It wasn't something that brought us closer to truth. It was something that almost cut us off from being able to hear it.
Right. Mm-hmm. I would totally agree with that. My husband says that when Questions on Doctrine was printed, he was too young probably to remember that, but in the years that followed, he remembered his father huffing around the house going, "They sold us down the river. They sold us down the river." But at the same time, he and I grew up in a generation where the effects of Questions on Doctrine were having, they had this effect within Adventism where it was moving more and more towards something that sounded less distinctive. Mm-hmm. You know, we prided ourselves on being the peculiar remnant, but we kind of dropped that language and we started sounding more and more Christian. And yet, like Nikki says, underneath, the meanings never changed. And even though the way we talked about it changed, nobody told us the true gospel. Nobody could explain it. In fact, to this day, I have never met an Adventist to whom I could say, "What is the gospel?" and have them actually be able to tell me. So it didn't help the church. You know what? I am absolutely convinced that all this superficial whitewashing that these groups do to sound acceptable and to be seen as normal, it's like Nikki says, it cuts its people off from the gospel because they think they're there now, and they're really not. Their worldview is still stuck in the original worldview, and they don't know it.
Andrew, Andrew, what thoughts or commentary question do you have?
Yeah, it sounds to me like it's like you're talking about, Jerry. It's a form of information control and almost a form of thought control as well. Because if we think about the questions on doctrine that was released in 1957, since they specifically partitioned that certain leaders were going to be part of these conferences and certain conservative leaders that wouldn't bend the knee won't be part of these conversations, it seemed like they were trying to, quickly figure something out. And they made really, really bad decisions. And there's when there's one leading organization that's in control of all of the information, this shows you the damage that that happens from that, right? Like, so right. I'd say in biblical Christianity, we have the Bible as our sole rule of infallible faith in practice, the sole infallible rule of faith in practice, shall I say. And what we're seeing here is questions on doctrines is trying to whittle away certain things that Ellen G. White taught, right? Yeah. To make it seem like they fell more in line with Christian doctrine. But the truth is, though, is once they did that, it made things extremely confusing, because without Ellen G. White, and I think this is the point, you don't have Seventh-day Adventism. Without prophecy, without vision, you don't have it. So now we have a foundation that, as we can see, was not founded on the written word of God, but it was founded on the visions of a prophetess. And that's not a firm foundation. That's a foundation of sinking sand. And it leads to the faith of thousands of people, probably millions of people, being damaged. Like you said, it made it harder for you to hear the gospel, because why? You were brainwashed, in a sense. My question would be, after 1957, after the questions on doctrine, did this create like a divide, right? Where there was people who were trying to be staunchly more conservative. And do we see that now? Where they're trying to get back to Ellen G. White's teachings, and then another branch of people that are going another direction?
That's an interesting question. We've talked about this a lot among ourselves, because we deal, you know, especially with the podcast reaching a whole different younger generation of Adventists, we deal with a lot of emails from people. And I would say, yes, it fragmented the organization internally to a degree. It did. Where we live in Southern California is far more progressive and theologically liberal than, for example, the Adventists in Michigan by the seminary. But the fact is, there's still Adventists in their worldview. They may hotly argue with each other and deny certain beliefs. But here's the thing, and I think this is one of the things that unites them all and makes it so that you can't really say there's part of them that are looking, that are trying to be more Christian. I'm not going to say that there aren't individuals who aren't. There definitely are individuals who are wanting to understand. But as an organization, here's the thing. None of them believe in the inerrancy of Scripture. None of them. So without an inerrant Scripture, you don't have a certain and secure foundation. And they don't believe in inerrancy. In my generation, we were actively taught that the Bible is infallible, but not inerrant, that it literally does have errors because it is, it's time. It's a little time stamped. You have to think about the way the people understood God. They were writing about the way people, they were inspired by their thoughts, not their words. So they wrote it as they understood it. And the reason for that was Ellen White, they still say this, was inspired in the same way the Bible writers were inspired. So if you have a modern prophet inspired exactly in the same way with the same authority as the Bible writers, you can't have an inerrant Scripture, because they already knew they couldn't trust Ellen. They already knew they had to edit her because she contradicted herself. So that is like a foundation that is consistent among all Adventists everywhere, no matter what their flavor.
Go ahead, Nikki.
I was just going to say, too, that it seems related, like you mentioned, the Adventists in Michigan. I spent a lot of my teen years in New England. So kind of where you live in the country will also determine where you land in that fragmentation. Mm-hmm. And then you also have people who move away from Adventism because they're embarrassed of it, because it's kind of an awkward thing to have to explain to people.
Yeah.
And then you have people who move away because they have very liberal convictions, and you have people who are moving towards it because they're terrified and they have been traumatized. And I use that word intentionally. They've been traumatized with the last day doctrines of Adventism. And so they're not going to let go of the original teaching of Adventism. But among all of them, I don't really know very many who ever come to the gospel.
I agree.
In this ministry, there are many, but out there in the boots on the ground Adventist communities, very often they become agnostic. So that even with the different views of Adventism within Adventism, the gospel isn't there.
Okay. No, thank you so much for sharing that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a clip, and I discussed this with you earlier. This is a clip later on, and again, Walter Martin was, 26 years old. I mean, Well, think about what were you doing when you're 26 years old? I mean, this is the first time when you wrote.
I know.
one of the most definitive works in Christian literature in the last 100 years. And again, there's several editions, but the very first edition, when you're 26 years old, I wasn't definitely qualified to do that for sure. So you do have to admire him for his work. So this is a bit later on when Walter Martin, all these years later, is on the John Ankerberg Show. Explain to everyone just the context of this episode of the John Ankerberg Show, and then we're going to play the opening segment. It is about 4 minutes, but I want to make sure we give context so people versus playing mm-hmm. it at the very beginning of the episode. Go ahead.
After Questions on Doctrine had been printed, which had been printed to put into print and make official what the Adventists had told Walter Martin Adventist doctrine was, the first printing was widely distributed to Adventist leaders around the world and to Christians in various academic settings and so forth, just to try to explain Adventism in this new light. But that first printing was never repeated. It went out of print. And it was never republished. And one thing that was really a troublesome thing to Walter Martin was that the Adventists had promised him, he had said that he was going to, subsequent to writing The Kingdom of the Cults, he was going to write a volume on Seventh-day Adventism. He had come to believe that people who believed and articulated what he thought these men had talked to him about, he thought they could be true Christians. So he was going to write an explanatory volume, and the Adventists had promised that they would sell that volume on Adventism in their bookstores, which still exist, mostly online, but they still exist, and next to The Kingdom of the Cults. Well, Adventists never sold. They reneged on their promise. They wouldn't sell his book. So that was a big red flag to Walter Martin. Where did Questions on Doctrine go? Why won't they republish it? Why aren't they selling my book? And besides that, it doesn't sound like they're saying the same things they were saying to me. So that was what happened after 1957. And then we fast forward to this John Ankerberg Show in, what is it, 1984? Mm-hmm. Five?
Around that
time. And by this time.
Yeah, 1985.
By this time. I'm sorry. By this time, hundreds of pastors and professors had lost their positions because they were teaching from Questions on Doctrine, and they were teaching some of the things that they had professed to believe now, and it cost them their job. And so Walter Martin was getting word of this. He had lists, he said, of hundreds of these people. And he's saying, why are you telling me that you still hold to these truths, but people are losing their jobs over teaching them? He was upset.
Yes, he was. And another thing that didn't come up in the Walter Martin thing, but which had immediately, just actually about 4 years before, preceded it, was the debacle with Desmond Ford and his widely publicized paper, which he presented to Adventist leaders in 1980, showing from the Bible that their core central pillar doctrine of the investigative judgment can't be proven from Scripture. And so that, combined with the wording of Questions on Doctrine, caused many Adventist pastors and teachers to lose their positions because, you know, they had this document, this old book that wasn't in print any longer, sounding like they weren't historic Adventists, and right. Des Ford saying, this isn't true. And they were starting to write to Walter Martin, and the church was not giving them answers. Mm.
Okay. Excellent. No, thank you for that details. Thank you for that context. So again, I'm going to play this clip and just take everything that Colleen said into consideration. Just bear in mind, this clip is about 4 minutes long, but it's very, very important to pay attention because this is going to give context to what Colleen just said. Then afterwards, we are going to go ahead and unpack that, and we'll have one additional clip we'll play as well, too, and we'll unpack that as well. So here is the first clip from the opening segment of this classic episode from the John Ankerberg Show.
We're glad that you joined us tonight. Tonight, our guests are Dr. William Johnson, the editor of the Adventist Review, the official organ of the Seventh-day Adventist denomination, and Dr. Walter Martin, who is well known for many of his writings on the cults, as well as the contemporary religious philosophy today in our country. Gentlemen, we're glad that you're here, and I thought that on the topic of Seventh-day Adventism, Dr. Johnson, the man that is sitting next to you, in your book that you put out in 57, Questions on Doctrine, that was the official statement of the Seventh-day Adventist denomination to non-Adventists, to the world, in a sense, there was a compliment to the guy sitting next to you, namely that you appreciated the fact that when he, with other scholars from other non-Adventist churches, came to you and asked questions, you appreciated the fact that he came to you directly. He came to the denominations and denomination and did research. And Walter, I'd like for you to kind of go back as we start. How did you get into going to the denomination? What was that process and what happened?
Well, I was doing research on the various cults of the time, and I'd written a book, The Rise of the Cults, and I received a letter from Leroy Froome, a top Seventh-day Adventist scholar and historian, the man who wrote The Prophetic Faith of Our Fathers and other books. And he took issue with me over the classification of Seventh-day Adventism as a cult. And I contacted him back again, and I said I was sorry he took issue, but that I had quite a bit of information which indicated to me that they were. And he said, well, it wasn't accurate. So I went to Dr. Barnhouse, who was the editor of Eternity Magazine. I worked for Eternity at the time. And I said, this is a very responsible man, and I think we ought to investigate this. And Dr. Barnhouse said, why don't you go down to Washington and talk with them? But I know they're a cult because I grew up in Mountain View, California, and I met with them all the time out there, and they were always giving me the mark of the beast and everything else. He said, you're wasting your time. He said, don't bother.
But you went, I said, you went down to Washington.
Oh, yeah, I went down there, and I met with Roy Allen Anderson, who was the editor of the Ministry Magazine at the time, and the head of all Seventh-day Adventist ministers and missionaries throughout the world. And then I met with W.E. Reed, who was a special consultant to the General Conference, Leroy Froome, and T.E. Unruh, who had gotten the whole thing started by discussing with us also in Pennsylvania, where we were headquartered, some of the things about Adventism.
Tell us what your conclusion was.
I came out with the conclusion in 1956. And Eternity Magazine came out with the conclusion that Seventh-day Adventists who acknowledge the things that their denomination were telling us had to be regenerate Christians and evangelicals and could not be classified as a cult. However, there were Adventists that were on the other side of the fence, and we recognized them too. We spent the time down there going over their literature, which was a morass of contradictions. And materials that could be juxtaposed back and forth, either cultic or non-cultic, depending upon who wrote it. We had to go through that with a whole group of scholars and men from their publishing houses and theologians to sift through all of the materials. And the result of it, I propounded a series of questions to them. And the series was later put into the book, which you mentioned before, Questions on Doctrine. It was the first time that a non-Adventist scholar and expert on the cults had gone to the Adventists, sat down with them, discussed their theology openly, frankly, and freely. And I believe to this day, the men I dealt with on the committee and Reuben Figure and the theologians who worked with us were thoroughly honest men.
All right. Go ahead. And you gave some commentary prior to the clip, kind of giving context. Give me your immediate thoughts, any commentary on this clip you want to add in addition to what you gave previously.
Well, I just start by saying, number one, I don't believe those men were honest. History will show the annotations in the republished Questions on Doctrine mm-hmm. have clips from letters between these men, George Knight's own commentary on based on the collection of data that he has. They deliberately did lie to him. They didn't tell Walter Martin the truth. But I would also say, I think one of the things Martin did, and I understand why he did it, we're always told, why don't you go to the people themselves and ask them what they believe? Don't ask these former Adventists what they believe. Don't right. just go straight to the, if you are a false religion, you are not going to tell the truth. I mean, we grew up in a falsehood that we believed was remnant truth. But, you know, Paul talks in 2 Corinthians 11 about that angel of light. And in Galatians 1, he says, if we are an angel from heaven come to you with the gospel other than we preach, let him be accursed. There are people, there are organizations who teach false gospels that are not true. And it doesn't matter how sincere they sound and how convincing they are. Walter Martin kind of reminds me, he was completely deceived. I don't blame him, but there was a discernment issue because he went to them and trusted the actual leaders of this group. And it reminds me a little bit of Eve in the garden discussing the word of God with the serpent. and getting completely off because they were discussing the word instead of her obeying it.
Yeah.
You know, there are two aspects to this ministry. Primarily, we want to see people come out of Adventism and to the gospel and to know God, to know what's true about him. But we also have a big concern for Christians who are being deceived by Adventism. And so when I hear this clip with Walter Martin, kind of my first instinct is to feel protective. Mm-hmm. And sympathy for him, because he is sitting there, even the words he's using reveals that they lied to him to mm-hmm. call Adventists regenerate Christians.
Yes.
They don't believe in regeneration. And for William Johnson to sit there and allow Walter Martin to refer to Adventists as regenerate Christians when he would say, yeah, that's not how we understand anything. Mm-hmm. He should have stopped him there. I mean, just on that point, but he sat there and allowed him whatever language they wanted to use to accept Adventism was okay with them. So I feel protective for Walter Martin. And then I also I feel pretty convicted, pretty certain that he was lied to by the men in the 50s and by William Johnson next to him.
Yeah.
Andrew, what thoughts or questions do you have about this happening clip?
Yeah, I'd have to echo that as well. I think that they did feed him information that they lied to him about. I mean, that's why the John Ankerberg show was airing this in 1985, yeah. right? Because this was, I'm horrible at math. I don't know, 38 odd years later or 28 odd years later. So things had been happening where, yeah. like you guys were talking about, Colleen and Nikki, that people were losing their jobs because they were actually teaching yeah. what Questions on Doctrine taught. And they're like, sorry, you guys actually shouldn't teach that. They don't even print that book anymore. So Walter Martin's knowing that all of this is going on. So what he wants now is like, well, what is the truth? I think that even the title of the John Ankerberg show for this is called Who's Telling the Truth About Seventh-day Adventism? Mm-hmm. And a quote from Walter Martin a little bit later on from this episode, he says this, he says, I fear that if they continue to progress at this rate, that the classification of a cult can't possibly miss being reapplied to Seventh-day Adventism. That's what Walter Martin yeah. said. So he's trying to figure it out. And what we got to remember as well is back then in the 80s or even in the 50s, like we didn't have information the same way we have it today. So he's going off of what he knows in trusting people. But we know that God will sort this out, right? If someone is lying, it will be sorted out. And Walter Martin was just trying to be the type of person that we try to be even on the show on Cultish. We try to, if someone we think may be a Christian, we want to treat them as a Christian. So he's giving somebody the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And then he gets taken advantage of in a sense, but also he's also very wise. That's why they're back on the show to try to figure out exactly what is going on. And if they are a cult, it needs to be said.
Yeah. And I'm so grateful that you guys are willing to do this series because the issue seems to have died with Walter Martin passing on. And so it's the Kingdom of the Cult is kind of this definitive work on the cults, and people aren't picking up the issue of Seventh-day Adventism again. And I really truly believe that if Walter Martin were still with us and he had seen the publication of their Clear Word Bible,
yes,
or he had read the book 28 Fundamental Beliefs and read each of the chapters, he would have had no trouble whatsoever calling them a cult.
And speaking of the Clear Word, it's very interesting. We actually associate in ministry with Paul Cardin, as I believe we mentioned this in the first chapter of this program. He is the executive director of the Centers for Apologetics Research, and Paul Cardin used to work with Walter Martin. He was the co-host of the Bible Answer Man with him for 6 years. So he knew Walter Martin very well. And when he met us in 2007, he knew something was off with Adventism. He didn't completely know it, what it all was, but he's worked with us, and to his credit, he's listened to us over the years, and he is actually sees. But I remember years ago, he said to us, if the Clear Word had been in existence when Walter Martin was alive, he would have seen immediately something was wrong, because it's their own Bible. It's their internal paraphrase. And you know what's so interesting? The man, Jack Blanco, who did the paraphrase of the Clear Word, and there are many iterations of it. There were early ones, there were partial New Testaments, books of John, different things like that. The very first edition of his Clear Word product, which he hadn't called the clear word yet, but it was a paraphrase of the New Testament. He published that 1 year after Walter Martin died. It was 1 year after Walter Martin died that that first clear word came out. And the thing with the clear word is Jack Blanco, who used to be the head of the religion department at Southern Adventist University in Tennessee, he claims he did it as a devotional help for his grandchildren. But the fact is, the clear word has become a staple within Adventism. But once again, like with most things Adventism publishes that they don't want the public to understand, they call it unofficial. Oh, no, 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 it's not our special Bible. It's just a devotional help for people's private study. But if you go to the Adventist Book Center, it is sold as a Bible. And it is structured as a Bible. It has all the books of the Bible, all the chapters, all the verses. But what's unique is that it has the Adventist viewpoint woven into every single text of that book.
Because the one place you think of it like a video game where you have to like hit, you're fighting a boss. And this is just me being my inner nerd is talking right now. But you like say it's like, and Andrew, you know about this. All of a sudden, like there's like weak spots, right? Where you have to hit this point. This point to defeat the boss. Well, as a cultist, if the one weak spot you want to go to is John 1:1, or any that's a major area of the deity of Christ. Do they do anything there, or any other the basic verses of the deity of Jesus, or like what are like the big ones that kind of push it into the anyone that goes too far realm from your perspective?
We need a clear word.
Yeah, we do need the clear word. If you really want the key one, it's Daniel 8:14, because Daniel 8:14 is unto 2,300 days and then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. That's the KJV version of it. Mm-hmm. And that is the key central passage to uphold their core doctrine of the investigative judgment. In the clear word, that verse is not one sentence of about 8 to 10 words. It's several sentences. It's a paragraph this long in the book, and it goes on about right in the concept of the investigative judgment where Jesus enters the heavenly sanctuary and opens the books and cleanses heaven by going through the sins of the saved. So that would be one of the most obvious, but throughout the book, it's not Genesis 1:1. I'm sorry. It's not John 1:1 that they alter. It's the texts here and there, especially in the book of John, where Jesus talks about himself and his father. And he very clearly identifies himself and his father as separate. I mean, he'll say, instead of saying the Father and I are one, the clear word says, the Father and I are so close, it's as if we're one. So the Trinitarian aspect of Jesus and the Father being one and the Spirit being just like, same substance, that's all morphed and changed, but it's very subtle. And you have to actually know what the real one says.
So would it be sort of very like pseudo, like modalistic when it comes to where there's not a distinction with the Father?
No, it's more tritheistic.
Oh, okay.
It's more tritheistic. In fact, Ellen White, as late as 1905, 1907 or 8, was writing about the Trinity as the heavenly trio and the three worthies of heaven. And Jerry Moon at Andrews Seminary in 2006 wrote a very long document on how the heavenly trio is the correct view of the Trinity, not the classic Christian Trinity. That's current. No Adventist that I know, unless they've been converted in from Christianity, really understands that God, that the three persons of the Trinity share substance, attributes, all the same. They don't understand that. I didn't.
No, the doctrine of simplicity was brand new after Adventism. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they will refer to the Holy Spirit as the Spirit of Christ. And the only way that Christ can be omnipresent is through the Spirit of Christ, which seems modalistic to me. But you have the Spirit being talked about a lot as an it and a force and power.
Because that was the original view of the founders.
So then the Father has a body. And Jesus doesn't have all of the attributes of God. So you don't have the God of the Bible.
No. And Jesus is not omnipresent. And I keep thinking that's one of the most glaring revelations, if you really understand that that's one of the incommunicable attributes of God, is that he is omnipresent, but Jesus, they say, is not, because he has a body.
Wow.
Wow.
Andrew, what do you have any thoughts or commentary quickly? Or
if you questions? Want, I just pulled up the differences between, I can read Daniel 8:14 from the ESV and then read Daniel 8:14 from the Clear Word real quick, just to give people an idea of how this paraphrase works. Yeah. So here's the ESV. It says, "And he said to me, for 2300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." Daniel 8:14 ESV, Clear Word. "He answered, after 2300 prophetic days," in parentheses, which represent actual years, "God will restore the truth about the heavenly sanctuary to its rightful place. Then the process of judgment will begin, of which the yearly cleansing of the earthly sanctuary was a type, and God will vindicate his people." Very clearly, like, not the actual translation of the Bible here. But yeah, so that's just a good example, really, of some of the changes that are in there. But there's multiple changes with regards to the Clear Word, like Michael the Archangel, right? Like things of that nature with regard to Jesus and his deity. Is that correct? Absolutely. Like in Jude?
Absolutely. Yes. Oh, yeah. So that it is a doctrine of Adventism that Jesus is Michael the Archangel. A lot of Adventists, especially younger ones, don't even know that's a doctrine, but it is a doctrine. And they base it on Jude, where Michael contends with Satan for the body of Moses. And then, but says, "The Lord rebuke you." It says, Michael was not willing to utter a scathing rebuke to the devil, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." And Ellen White made quite a point of saying that Michael was Jesus. But the fact is, Jesus rebuked Satan directly when he was on earth in his human mortal body. He's the Lord. Yeah. So that part alone should disqualify him as Jesus. But they have to have Jesus as Michael in Jude, because if they don't have Moses, because Ellen White teaches that that's a text explaining that Jesus resurrected Moses. And we all grew up thinking Moses was resurrected, because if he wasn't, he couldn't have appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus and Elijah. The Adventist doctrine is that when you're dead, you're dead. You don't exist anymore until the resurrection. So Moses had to be resurrected in order to show up, and they go to Jude and Michael the Archangel to prove he was resurrected so he could appear there.
In Seventh-day Adventism, are angels created beings?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
In other words,
drop the mic.
Okay.
Yeah. But
so do you see? I'm putting two and two together. Yeah. You know where I'm going with this. What do you think about that?
In cultic systems, there are very few logical conclusions.
Right.
You have to live with duplicitous ideas. You can't think. You know, in the BITE model, they control. They say that. Under thought control, they want to manage what you do with doubts and what you are willing to examine and look at. And so you have to keep all of these different dueling ideas together in your head and then exercise some kind of willpower to not examine them.
Right, exactly.
Or you're faithless.
And the way the Adventist organization has dealt with Michael in more recent decades is to simply say, "Oh, no, Jesus is not an angel. That's just a name for him. It's just a name."
Yeah.
But, you know, it still doesn't explain Daniel 10 with Michael being one of the princes and the prince of your people. And it doesn't explain Jude, where Michael refused to utter a scathing rebuke against Satan, but said, "The Lord rebuke you," because Jesus clearly rebuked Satan.
Right. Jumping back to, and I appreciate you clarifying that. And again, maybe we can explore this further in part two. Jumping back to the conversation with Walter Martin and on the John Ankerberg show, what was the name of the person that they had selected to be his counterpart on that episode?
That was William Johnson.
Who was he, and why was he chosen? The reason why I asked
that's a good question.
Because the reason why I thought of that, you mentioned earlier that the original people that met with Walter Martin back when he was 26 years old, they were carefully hand-selected. I would only assume this person was hand-selected as well. But yeah, just tell him like who he was and why was he picked to be on the show?
Go ahead.
Well, my understanding, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding was no one really wanted to do this.
And William Johnson was instructed by then Neil Wilson, the president of the Seventh-day Adventist organization at the time. He was instructed to go on and just be sweet, just be nice, and talk about righteousness by faith. They're going to try to nail you down, but just do these things and you'll be able to get through it. So there was something about this man that he thought he could just be sweet, that he was capable of presenting this sweet Christian mannerism.
He was the editor at that time of the Adventist Review, which is the official organ of the Adventist Church. Mm-hmm. And he had also been a professor at Andrews Seminary in Old Testament or something. I can't remember exactly what his, but he was, he had a proven track record of loyalty to the organization, of upholding the doctrines. And keep in mind, this is 1984, when in the past 4 years, actually scores, if not, you know, a few hundred professors and pastors have been fired for not standing up for the investigative judgment and for not necessarily holding on to all the unique doctrines. So William Johnson was loyal. He was nothing if not loyal, and he knew the doctrines. He was educated. He understood Adventism, and he wasn't going to sell them down the river. But he was selected to go, I believe, because Neil Wilson, as Nikki said, he wouldn't go. He wouldn't go, the president. And it's interesting that the president, Neil Wilson, that was president then, is the father of the current president, Ted Wilson, who has been president for 22 years, which is a very long time. COVID sort of extended things. Mm. And he's very conservative, just like his father was. So there's been a consistent thread in recent modern Adventism that's been forcing it back towards its roots, its historic roots, its honoring of Ellen White.
Wow. What do you think? I mean, if anyone's wondering, if you type in Walter Martin's Seventh-day Adventism, I think it's one of the first results. You see the entire, I think, 5-part series all in a 2-hour segment.
Yeah.
It was interesting me being on the outside looking in, and especially with you, your vantage point is very unique and distinct from Andrew and I. It seemed to me as like, man, this guy does seem very kind. He seems very sincere, and he's doing the best he can to explain, you know, assuming the best of the Seventh-day Adventism. Uh-huh. But as it progressed, it seemed to be a little bit more of, you know, you think of the current White House briefings. And, you know, at least I got to say that, honestly, if we want to talk politics for a second, Jen Psaki, I kind of miss her. Like, she was my favorite because you knew that at least when somebody was going to ask something, she was the ultimate spin doctor. She could spin it like crazy. This new gal, like, she is so cringe. It's like, no matter what, it just like, she'll try and twist it or whatever. It just seemed that as it was progressing, it went from being, he was really like repeating, you know, the same things over and over and over again. And again, Walter and John Ankerberg, especially even with John being the host, he was being as gracious as possible, saying, well, I think there's one moment where he said, refer to our doctrines of faith. You know what I'm talking about. But then John Ankerberg says, you're touching what he touched. This previous guest who was then fired, that was on the John Ankerberg show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you think? What was his heart and his motive? Did he genuinely believe what he was saying on the show?
You mean William Johnson?
Who is on the who is adjacent to Walter Martin? Like, did he honestly believe what he was saying on the show, or what do you think he was saying? What people wanted to hear, or what's your perspective being so on the outside looking in, or inside?
I would say yes to all of it.
On the inside, yeah. Go ahead.
Inside. Mm-hmm. I'd say all of it. All of it. I think that they believe their own lies.
Yeah.
Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them. And I think that's one of the reasons they chose him. And in this article that was written to kind of reveal some of what was going on behind the scenes, there's this quote here from William Johnson describing what was going on inside him as he was being interviewed. And he said, "Inside, I was beginning to boil. And this was purportedly a Christian television show?
Yes, the name of Jesus was mentioned along with references to the Bible and various Christian doctrines, but attitude, the spirit of the show was overwhelmingly negative, designed to put the Seventh-day Adventist Church in a bad light. So he did not experience what I as a Christian see looking at that show. I see Walter Martin and I see John Inkerberg expressing love and concern
and calling
for
him
the
a
Seventh-day
brother.
Adventist. And calling him a brother, calling him, telling them repeatedly that they love him, that what they love about him is that he's willing to be there and that he's willing to tell them the truth. And I'm sitting here inside looking on and I'm just, my heart's breaking for these men because I know that this means something to them. You know, one of the sound bites on the intro to your show, you hear Walter Martin saying that, you know, brother, I love you, but you're in a cult. And I love that heart that's there.
Yeah.
But they can't even perceive it because when you start asking questions, they can't answer. And all they can generate is this mantra that they've been taught and told to give back to Christians. They feel like a trapped animal. Mm-hmm. And they, you do get that boiling sensation inside because you don't know where to go with it. And so you just assume bad motives.
Hmm. Yeah. I remember the moment in that interview where they were talking about the teaching in the investigative judgment that a believer's sins are marked pardoned until the end of the investigative judgment. And only then, if all of them are confessed, is the word forgiven entered in the books of heaven. And then they're completely free of their period of probation and the sins are dismissed and put onto Satan as scapegoat. And I remember Walter Martin asking William Johnson, so are your sins pardoned? And Johnson looked at him and said,
yes,
they are forgiven. And Walter Martin said, but are they, which comes first, pardoned or forgiven? I think pardoned comes for, he says, they're pardoned. And Walter Martin says, but are they forgiven? And Johnson wouldn't answer. He was caught. He looked caught and he said, they're taken care of. Mm-hmm. And Walter Martin gave it to him. He smiled and said, you know, okay, brother. You know, kind of laughed.
I remember
that. But I thought, no, right there, it's like a keyhole. Open that door.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Andrew, what are your thoughts or questions? When you were observing that video, what did you observe and what questions do you have for Colleen or Nikki?
Oh, just thinking about what was going on with William Johnson. Well, he wrote an autobiography, I believe it was in 2008, called Embrace the Impossible. And if you recount how he talks about what was going on in this interview and you compare it to the transcript of the interview, you can see that he is saying one thing that is actually recorded as being totally opposite. And I find that if you back a cat into a corner, those types of things begin to happen. And I just wish that there would be a way to just for this man to be like, you know what, these things happened and this is how I need to look at them, instead of trying to continually save face for the SDA. You know, they put him out there as a scapegoat in a sense, and he got it right. Like supposedly, you know, he wrote a doctoral dissertation on Hebrews 9:10. And He says this in his autobiography, and there's a great article, by the way, on lifeassuranceministries.org that is written that recounts all of this. And I recommend as well, guys, for the listeners here, to go to the YouTube and type in 1982 John Inkerberg, Desmond Ford, and Walter Ray, and then go to this as well to try to get the whole situation of what's going on here, because that's an excellent interview as well. But anyways, Johnson recounts this when he talks to Martin about Hebrews 9. He says, just for a few minutes, I found respite. Martin moved into the book of Hebrews. Soon, however, he realized that I was well-versed in that area, so he dropped Hebrews and went to a different subject. But if you actually look at the transcript on the John Inkerberg show, it shows something totally different. We have it recorded. The recording is a witness that is a grace from God. It says, Martin says, and with the person who wrote the article, an older definitive work on tahagia, which is the word there, the Greek word that they're referencing, admit to the Adventist doctrine of 1844 in the second apartment of the sanctuary and Jesus going in there. Would they say that Hebrews 9 would admit that? Johnson says, I don't think you get all that from Hebrews 9. Martin says, oh no, not at all from Hebrews 9. And then Johnson is the one who redirects the discussion to the judgment seat of Christ. And the only reason why I'm saying that is because you were asking the question earlier, Jerry, is, well, What about Johnson? What is he thinking? And I think in his autobiography, if you're going to not accurately represent something in 2008, which was years later when there's already a transcript of this conversation, which I pray that he must be knowledgeable of that. There's something going on there. There's something going on there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And if someone's willing to lie about a little, they're willing to lie about much.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's the thing. And this is this observation is coming from our work with this ministry, with people who have questioned Adventism, danced around the edges. Some leave and find Jesus, and some say, oh, no, I can't. And here's the thing. If you have met the real Jesus and know the gospel, if you stay where he is misrepresented and mistaught and the gospel is misrepresented, then you are doing great disservice. You are dishonoring the Lord Jesus. And I have to ask, are you really born again? But see, that is the Adventist question, because they don't believe. They have an immaterial spirit that's born dead. I mean, I just recently, just this last week, got an email from an Adventist about that very subject, taking us to task for an article we had printed about hell.
Yeah.
They don't understand the concept of spiritual death. And they will argue and fight against it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting too, just because even for me, again, who's on the Andrew and I are on the outside looking in, this is one of many topics where we jump into on a regular basis. Just listening to that dialogue in that moment when Walter asks, "Are your sins forgiven?" and then he gives that sort of congressional hearing sort of answer. I mean, right away. Like my hair just is like my spidey sense just went off. It's like, somebody can state something and they may not articulate it in a way that sounds kind of off, but they're not giving a political answer. They're saying it because of a misunderstanding, not a thorough understanding, and then then explaining it in a sort of congressional hearing sort of way. and you totally dig that. But this is incredibly intriguing. So why don't we go ahead and do this? We've gone for a little bit. We're going to do a quick seventh inning stretch. This is part one of chapter two. Is Seventh-day Adventism a cult? In part two, we're going to continue the conversation about this meeting with Walter Martin. Also, we're going to talk about Seventh-day Adventism today versus this meeting then, and also then talk to just a little bit about hopefully your ministry and what it's like with your interactions with Seventh-day Adventists who are leaving, who are active. We're going to kind of get into that as well too, just so we can get an overview of just everything that you all do on a regular basis. Before we wrap up, just tell everyone again, where's the website where people can find out about you?
ProclamationMagazine.com.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening in. And if you like this content, and if you like to get programs like content like this to continue on a regular basis, go to thecultistshow.com. There is a donate tab. You can donate one time or become a monthly partner with us. All that being said, we'll talk to you all next time on Cultish, where we enter into the kingdom of the cults. Talk to you guys soon.